Good afternoon, everyone. I'm John Turan, Senior Vice President with Kepler Speakers, and welcome to the first of three power keynote sessions that we were very proud to sponsor at Meet Different 2009. Over the next 3 days, we'll be presenting three diverse, dynamic, and inspiring voices on surviving and thriving in today's difficult business climate. I want to give you a sneak peek, first off, of the speakers that are going to be performing on Monday and Tuesday in this same room. Allison Levine, who is in the front row, if you want to stand up, Allison. Allison Levine is a groundbreaking polar explorer and leader of the first American women's expedition on Mount Everest. Allison knows a thing or two about extreme environments, and I know you'll be energized by her presentation tomorrow on surviving and thriving in the extreme. Allison will be speaking tomorrow morning at 10:15, and that will be in this room. On Tuesday, we're lucky enough to have Warren Brown. Anyone here from Washington, D.C. may be familiar with Cake Love, a chain of bakery cafes in our nation's capital. On Tuesday morning at 10:45, also in this room, we'll be hearing from the founder of Cake Love, and he'll be sharing his story of success on why passion is so critical to surviving and thriving in any career. I'm also joined by my colleague, Kelly Skibbe, Vice President with Kepler Speakers, also in the front row. Kelly and I will be available after all the power keynotes to answer any questions you may have about your speaker needs. And we also have literature available at a table in the back by the door to the your right that has literature available about Kepler Speakers and also some of the speakers that are being presented here this week. We also have a short video that we'd like to run about Kepler Speakers and some of our services.
We've probably booked well in excess of 20,000 different programs in the 25 years since we formed Kepler Speakers. But one thing that hasn't changed is our commitment to providing the right speaker for each event.
Hi, Bobby.
When that speaker comes in, we know that the people that planned it, that rely on us, know we've given them everything we have.
When I'm working with a client, I'm part of their company, I'm part of their association. I've got a vested interest in the success of the event.
Because Kepler knows their speakers and they understand what our goal is and what our audience is, they make us look very, very good.
One of the things we looked at to set ourselves apart was to identify those who are real people with real stories.
Not only are our speakers truly the most inspiring, the most motivational on the circuit, they're in some ways changing communities one speech at a time.
That you'll achieve the dreams that you want.
I think Kepler tries to connect people to speakers who will reach in and touch their hearts.
One of the greatest thrills I've ever gotten when one of our speakers told about being stranded on Mount Everest, left there for dead, and the only inspiration that got him to come back down the mountain was the thought of seeing his family again. There wasn't a dry eye in the house. Moments like that really change lives, and that's what makes this business all worthwhile.
And now let's turn our attention to today's speaker. We learned this morning at the opening general session that there are many challenges to the meetings and conventions industry in this current environment. To help put this challenging economic landscape into perspective, we turn to veteran journalist Stuart Varney. Stuart anchors the noon to 2 p.m. time slot of Fox News' Business Network, or FBN. He also appears on several of the business shows on the Fox News channel. Stuart began his career as one of the founders of CNN. He was the first person to broadcast for the network from New York. He went on to win the Peabody Prize for his coverage of the 1987 stock market crash and has covered virtually every major business story since. After anchoring CNN's Moneyline in the late 1990s, he went on to present the Wall Street Journal editorial board with Stuart Varney for CNBC, and he joined Fox as a correspondent in December 2003. Educated at the London School of Economics, Stuart Varney can make the world of money sound understandable and entertaining for any audience. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Stuart Varney.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thanks, John. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. As you just heard, I work for the Fox News Channel and the Fox Business Network. So to invite me to Atlanta, home of CNN, is somewhat like inviting me onto enemy territory. But I can assure you, ladies and gentlemen, I'm absolutely delighted to be here. And since, well, of course I'm delighted to be here in weather like this. And you would be too if, like me, for the last 28 years, you'd lived in New Jersey. So thank you very much indeed for inviting me to be with you. And, you know, you may think that MPI is little known outside of our immediate industry. You may think that the establishment media has no clue about MPI. You are absolutely wrong. It is broadly known, it is very well known, that MPI is a sharp, intelligent, well-managed organization. You don't know this, but I do. I know this from my own personal experience. When we were making plans for me to be with you this Sunday in Atlanta, someone from MPI called up my agent and said, "Does Mr. Varney believe in free speech?" What kind of a question is that for a man who works for the Fox News Channel, may I ask? And of course, your agent says, "Yeah, of course Stuart Varney believes in free speech." Whereupon MPI said, "In that case, will he give one?" Well, you know, you will therefore be very pleased to realize that my remarks this afternoon will be unbelievably short, ladies and gentlemen. So I appreciate being here. Now look, when you make a public presentation about the economy, and you try to plan it months in ahead, these days, you cannot do that. You simply cannot do it. Because in this particular moment in our economic history, it is really unique. Because the events are cascading. They're just bowling over each other. Events that would have lasted a week or a month's worth of headlines are cascading out every hour, every half hour. I mean, just look at today, for example. Today, I get up, I tune in Fox, I'm listening to the radio, I'm on the net, and what do I see? What extraordinary events have happened today? Well, we are about to approve an $827 billion stimulus package, and tomorrow we're going to consider funding a $3 trillion bank. $827 billion, $3 trillion, all happened this morning. Those are the headlines you wake up to today. How can you possibly plan a month in advance what you're going to say when you're talking about this kind of cataclysmic developments in the economy? The result is that whatever script I had arranged for today, I've torn up. You have to. You've got to go with exactly what's happening now. So here's what I want to lay out for you this afternoon, if I may. I want to divide it into three sections. First of all, how on earth did we get here? What led up to these extraordinary events? And how do we get here? I want to draw a timeline of literally the last 4 months. Because that 4 month period is absolutely unique in our financial history. I don't care how old you are. You've never seen anything like this before. So I want to lay out a timeline as to how we got here. Section one. Section two, where are we now? Exactly where are we now? And for this part of the presentation, I want to dig a little deeper than just talking about the Federal Reserve or the Treasury or TARP and all that kind of thing. I want to dig a little deeper because where we are now, in my opinion, I think we're at the cusp of a change in our financial culture. So dig beneath the stock market and the economy and talk about our financial culture, our way of dealing with and thinking about money. We're about to change. It really is going through a change right now. What am I talking about? Here's my story. For the past generation, America has been geared towards wealth creation. That was our financial culture. Today, where we are now is a shift. A shift towards wealth redistribution. I don't care whether you approve of this or disapprove of this, I'm saying this is reality. What you're seeing now, you're in the middle of a shift in the way we think about money and investing and our economic lives. Part three, where are we going? I've said, here's where we're coming from, here's where we are now, all right, where are we going? Well, I'm going to introduce what I think is the greatest challenge going forward. I'm not going to talk about recession or depression or rebound or anything else. I'm going to say that the greatest challenge we face going forward, and we're about to see it, is demographics, population shift. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this afternoon I'm going to talk to you about fertility rates. You thought this was going to be a boring old lecture on economics, didn't you? I know you did. I know you did. And you're asking, well, full disclosure right up front, I have six, count them, six children. So I am an expert on fertility rates. But you may well ask, why on earth is this guy with this exotic foreign accent, dressed like a refugee from Wall Street, in Atlanta, Georgia, on a Sunday afternoon, why is he talking about fertility rates? Answer? Throughout the developed world, fertility rates have fallen so far, so sharply, that approximately 45 countries are about to experience, or have already started to experience, absolute population decline. Not a slowing in the rate of growth of population, oh no, no, a flat-out decline. And as that's happening, all of these societies are aging. We're living longer. To cut a long story short, the big challenge economically for 40 or 50 countries, if not more, is a rapid growth in the population who is retired and living off the health and pension benefits of an ever smaller workforce, which in turn is having ever fewer children. That is a demographic challenge that we haven't even dreamed of yet. Some other societies have, we have not. Those are my three sections. Where are we coming from? Where are we now? Where are we going? Big challenge going forward. Okay, let me get started. How on earth did we arrive at this point where we are now? All right, it is my opinion that we started this merry-go-round, that this financial turmoil began, and you're going to think I'm crazy, but it began around 12 noon on September the 18th, 2008. Thursday, September the 18th, 12 noon, 2008. Now, that is a ridiculous-sounding comment, is it not? 12 noon to start the financial turmoil. What is it, an appointment book or something? No. Hold on a second. At 12 noon that day, September the 18th, the money flow seized up. It stopped. That was the credit crunch. Before that day, we'd seen Bear Stearns go out of business, Lehman went bankrupt, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley had converted from investment banks into commercial banks, Fannie and Freddie had been taken over by the federal government, AIG had been propped up to the tune of $150 billion by the federal government, WaMu and Wachovia and Countrywide had all gone, and the banking system was basically insolvent. All that had happened before Thursday, September the 18th, 12 noon. At that moment in time, there was a guy on a plane. His name is Bruce Bent. Bruce Bent was on a plane. He'd been ordered back from a vacation in Italy to come back to the States pronto. You don't know who Bruce Bent is, but in certain sections of the financial community, the man is a legend. You see, Bruce Bent invented the money fund. I'm sure you're familiar with money funds. Most of you will have some money in a money fund. That's that chunk of money. It's essentially a parking lot for money. You put your money in, it's dead safe. You can take it out whenever you like, tomorrow morning if you like, or next month or next year. Take it out, it pays interest. That is a money market mutual fund. Bruce Bent invented them back in 1970. Back in the days when what you earned on your money was regulated by the government. A checking account at a bank did not pay interest. The only interest-bearing account at a bank in 1970 were those little passbook savings accounts, which you never see these days. Bruce went out and just broke up everything. He invented the money market mutual fund. And now he's on a plane coming back, called back on an emergency basis from Italy. Why? Because his family of funds, mutual funds, the reserve family of money market mutual funds, which contained $86 billion, had just frozen. What do I mean by that? Couldn't get your money out. You could not get your money out. This had never happened before. You could not get your $86 billion out. All kinds of small businesses had an account, and they used to fund it. Their payroll would be funded by this money market fund, and it was frozen. That quickly spread to other money funds. If one freezes, they all freeze. At that moment, that was September the 18th, things froze. That was the credit crunch. It happened right there. The turmoil had begun. Forgive my language, all hell broke loose that Thursday afternoon. All hell broke loose because people in the financial industry realized this is the crunch. This is it. The money has stopped flowing. Henry Paulson, who was Treasury Secretary at that time, called a meeting. He convened the meeting in the White House, in the Oval Office. The President was there. The leaders of the Democrats and the Republicans in the House and the Senate were all there. Small group of people, but the political elite. Paulson lays down the law. You either give me $700 billion to rescue the financial system, or this thing crashes. What do you think a politician thinks when presented with such a challenge? If you don't do this, we crash. Do you want to get blamed for a crash? Of course not. All hell breaks loose in the political system as well as the economic system. There is a rush to come up with some kind of deal which can assemble $700 billion. Throughout the next week, starting Monday the 22nd of September, this $700 billion rescue package was assembled. Meanwhile, all hell's breaking loose still in the financial system. European banks quaked. They rocked. HBOS in Britain went under. The US stock market was starting to fall. Money was flowing into treasury securities, the ultimate safety land, and so it was flowing also into gold. By Monday, September the 29th, the rescue package was assembled. The House of Representatives voted on it, the $700 billion TARP program. That's what it was. Lo and behold, the House of Representatives rejects it, says no, votes it down. All hell breaks loose. The stock market really starts to take a dive. The politicians are terrified. It's going to crash. What do? They assemble another $110 billion worth of pork, chuck it into the bill. The Senate votes yes on it on Thursday. The House votes yes on it on Friday. Whoa, we've got a $700 billion rescue package. Thank the good Lord. Breathe a big sigh of relief. Not. Monday, September the 29th, the day after the passage of this extraordinary bill, is crash week. It happens, even though you've got the $700 billion. The Dow Jones Industrial Average that week went down 18%. Five European banks went under, had to be rescued by their own governments. Iceland went bankrupt. What? Iceland, ladies and gentlemen, there's a very small speck in the North Atlantic, but it is a sovereign state. It is part of NATO. It went belly up. What do you think is the impression given around the world when a sovereign state goes under, literally? The Europeans haven't got a clue what to do. We've got our $700 billion package. They are divided. They've got to get together with some kind of plan. But they're split. They are divided. This conversation actually took place. Gordon Brown, Prime Minister of Great Britain, gets on the phone and calls up Nicolas Sarkozy, the President of France. He says, Nicolas, we've got to get together. We've got to do something in a coordinated fashion. Now look, Nicolas, it's well known that the British hate the French, and the French hate the British, and everybody hates the Germans. We know this, but we've got to do something. They did. They got together. Over that weekend, that's the weekend of, that would be the weekend of Sunday, Saturday and Sunday, October the 11th and 12th. There's meetings in Paris and Washington, and all is going well. Looks like they've made an agreement. And then Silvio Berlusconi of Italy opens his mouth. Heaven help us, ladies and gentlemen. He says, and I'm not going to try to imitate the accent, Silvio says, well, you know, when you get into a bit of trouble in the markets, just close the markets. Can you imagine closing the world's financial markets because there's a few tremors here and there? How would you feel? You can't get at your money. If you think you ought to sell, you can't sell. If you want to buy, you can't buy. Your money, totally, around the world, is frozen. Silvio hurriedly retreats from that bizarre position. Agreement is reached. It's announced on the Sunday night. The Europeans will support all of their deposits in all of the banks. They will establish a 2 trillion euro fund to back up their financial system. That was a landmark, because until that point, the word trillion had not been used. It had been tens of billions 6 months previously, then it became hundreds of billions, and now, for the first time, it was trillions of dollars, euros, whatever. Trillions. The word was in play. Next day, this is a pivotal day, October the 13th, Henry Paulson, responding to the European plan to rescue the banks, convenes a meeting in the Treasury Department in Washington. The 9 leaders of the biggest banks in America are summoned. You will attend. 9 guys sitting across the table, beautiful mahogany table it is, I've been there. He's 9 guys sitting opposite Henry Paulson and Ben Bernanke, Fed chairman. He slides a single piece of paper across the table to each of the 9, and he says, read this and sign it, or sign it. You have no choice, you will sign it. And they did, because he was giving them, not giving, he was pumping in $125 billion of taxpayers' money into the preferred stock of the 9 largest banks and another $125 billion into the smaller regional banks around the country. You will take it. And they did. Sigh of relief. The Dow Jones Industrial Average that Monday went up 913 points. Everybody thought, we're home free. Whew, big sigh of relief. Wrong. The price of oil was now cascading down. It had dropped below $60 a barrel at that point, down $80 from its high. The Russian oligarchs were bankrupt. 10 of the leading Russian guys with the most money, 10 of them, had lost $230 billion in 10 weeks. Can you imagine such a thing? We had Mexico, we had the dollar rallying big time, went straight up. Everything else was down, the dollar went straight up. Big problem. Because of all those countries which owed money in dollars, not their local currency, in dollars. One day, the second largest retailer in Mexico is making a profit. The next day, it declared bankruptcy. Brazil, in serious trouble, cannot repay its foreign debt. Argentina, nationalized all private pension money. You see how this thing is rippling out of control? At that point, Obama won the election. That's November the 4th. He wins the election. Promptly, in the 10 days following it, the Dow Jones average went down 1,000 points. Detroit, bankrupt. The stimulus package, stimulus 2, now starting to be arranged. We're hearing $800 billion. The housing market is supposedly rescued by the Federal Reserve, which puts in $500 billion. And December the 11th, Madoff is arrested. Can you see this? I mean, I'm almost breathless here. These things are happening. Just one after another. There is a cascade of developments. So what now? Where are we now? It's February the what? 8th, 9th, something like that? Okay. What we have is a global recession. A big one, a severe global recession. Period. Big time. Real bad. In the next month, you may see the following countries go under. Remarkably, I'm saying countries go under. Russia, Ireland, Greece, Spain, Argentina, Venezuela, Iceland's already gone. All of those countries are in danger of sovereign wealth, sovereign debt default. The landscape of the financial marketplace, the landscape of America, has been rearranged in an extraordinary fashion in the time frame that I'm talking about. Hedge funds, there are 10,000 of them now. Within 3 months, they'll be down 5,000. They're going to be cut in half and regulated. Private equity, remember that? Wiped out, gone. Investment banks, they no longer exist. There used to be 4 investment banks which ruled the roost. Bear Stearns, Lehman, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley. There are no longer, they are no longer investment banks. They don't exist. The last 2 became commercial banks. The banks, all of them, insolvent, period. Insolvent. Not quite all of them, but the major commercial banks are insolvent without government money. And we are now thinking about a huge aggregator bank. It will be announced tomorrow, which may be capitalized with $3 trillion of taxpayer money. That, ladies and gentlemen, is where we are now. What an extraordinary ride it's been. September the 18th to now, 4 months, that's it. What a total, total shift. It has been. Have you ever lived through a period like this? Have you ever tried to write a script a month in advance as to what on earth is going to happen? Impossible. You've never, ever seen anything like this. Now, I'm painting a rather grim picture. But if you go back not too far, I mean, if you go back over the past generation, I'll make the case that America is, in fact, the best performing economy of all the industrial democracies by a long way. You've never heard this before, have you? Has the establishment media told you what a remarkable performance America has turned in the past generation? Not the past few months, the past generation, going all the way back 25 years. You've not been told this. In the past 25 years, that's 100 quarters, okay, you divide years into quarters for financial terms, 100 quarters, there's only been 5 quarters up until the fall of last year, 5 quarters where the economy shrank or remained flat. In 95 quarters, there's been growth. No other industrial society has managed to do that. None. Period. None. Economic growth, America wins. Unemployment, America wins. Job creation, America wins. Productivity, America wins. Period. All of it. You never heard that. The establishment media has not told you that. Period. You have not heard that. What do I mean by the establishment media? Katie Couric on the CBS Evening News. Have you ever heard her give a positive report about the state of the American economy? Up until September, this vigorous, knock-em-flat economy. Have you ever seen Katie smile? Rarely, ladies and gentlemen. Very rarely. ABC News? Nope. Nothing positive there. NBC? Nobody but communists. Oh, I'm sorry, I digress. But they're not positive on capitalism. They're not big on capitalism. Far from it. How about the Weather Channel? We're all going to die. Global warming. They're gone. CNN. I mean, I'm on dangerous ground now, but CNN, you know, the Clinton News Network. I mean, irreparably opposed to capitalism, basically. The major newspapers of this country, the Sacramento Bee, the San Francisco Chronicle, the LA Times, the Atlanta Constitution and Journal, the Boston Globe, the Washington Post, and, of course, the New York Times. Have you ever seen them take a positive approach to the United States of America, my adopted country? Do you think they're positive about it? Do you really? Never. Ever. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Won't. Won't happen. They do not like capitalism. They look for the negative. I'll make a... Rashly, I will make the following forecast. If the good Lord returned to earth tomorrow morning and walked across the Sea of Galilee, the headline in the next day's New York Times would read, Jesus can't swim. Okay. Let's move on. Point number two. Settle down. Point number two. Okay, I want to make the point that there's been a shift in our financial culture. I'll get to this real fast because it's not deep stuff, but it's hard to explain. What do I mean by financial culture? Well, I mean taxation policy, trade policy, regulatory policy. I think it's all going to shift. I think it's all going to shift towards the redistribution of wealth. We kind of got tired of a generation of wealth creation, which we were very good at, by the way. I mean, America has been a remarkable wealth creation machine. You may object to the way that wealth was spread around or not spread around. You can object to that all you like. But don't tell me that America has not been a wealth creation machine, the likes of which nobody can compete with. We have. We did that. Now we're shifting. Now we are going to shift big time to a regulatory, tax, and trade series of policies which stress fairness. You'll hear a lot of that. Fairness. And you'll also hear about the redistribution of the wealth we have created. Let's not dwell on this too long. I'm not saying whether you like it or not like it. I'm saying this is reality. But how do we get here? Why? Why is it that at this moment in time, that wealth creation machine should have become unpopular and we should wish to switch it around and change things? Why? Well, the obvious answer right up front is anybody who has a 401k, an IRA, or any kind of stock market investment has lost between 40 and 50% of their money. We all have. That doesn't make Wall Street and the fat cats particularly popular, now does it? Anybody who owns a home in the United States in the past 2 years has probably lost a minimum of 15% of the value of that home, probably more like 25 or 30%. Those values are gone. That's the destruction of wealth of the great American middle class, and it's not going to be popular. We are going to look for scapegoats. But it goes deeper than that. I think there is, and I think it's been to some degree fostered by the media, this, not anti-rich, that's silly, but it's an anti-Wall Street, anti-fat cat, anti-capitalist kind of thing. And I think we fostered this to some degree. Let me take you back to a guy called Dennis Kozlowski. Dennis ran a conglomerate called Tyco. He built it. You don't remember Dennis Kozlowski as building Tyco. You don't remember him as having looted the company for $300 million. Probably not aware that he's in prison for the rest of his life. What you may remember is something called a $6,000 shower curtain. Well, Dennis bought the $6,000 shower curtain with company funds. And because you could get a picture of that shower curtain, I put it on television. Television requires pictures. We're not radio. We're not the print media. You've got to have pictures. I got a picture of the shower curtain, and I put it on the air. I'm making a joke of it, but think of this. What public image did that display of the rich and the powerful in America? $6,000 shower curtain paid for with company money, my money, outrage. Then Dennis held a 50th birthday party on the island of Sardinia, paid for with company funds. The ballroom where this birthday party took place was very large. It was a bacchanalian revel. And in the center of the ballroom, there was an ice statue. Okay, this was a period of clear excess on Dennis's part. The ice statue was a male. Can you see where I'm going with this? The ice statue was a male, and it was peeing vodka. Okay? Now, I usually say urinating vodka, but with a British accent, you can get away with anything. So, the ice statue was peeing vodka. It was actually Stolichnaya. I happen to know that. And we got pictures of it. We put it on the air. What do you think is the image of that? What does that do? What does that do to the image of the fat cat? An ice statue peeing vodka with my money? Then you move along to Mr. Nardelli, Bob Nardelli. 6 years at Home Depot, not wildly successful. He left with $200 million. $200 million for 6 years of relative failure. He then moved on to Chrysler, which is now bankrupt. Okay. We then move up to fast forward to the present. Mr. O'Neill, Stanley O'Neill. He left Merrill Lynch virtually bankrupt and walked away with $164 million. Okay? There was Mr. Stuart Schwartzman, who runs a hedge fund. In the year 2006, dear Stuart, he made a salary, an income of $1 billion. And what income tax do you think he paid on that? What rate do you think he paid on that? Lower than anybody in this room. He paid 15% tax rate. It's called a pass-through capital gain, basically. Are you outraged? Of course you are. This is outrageous behavior. And we've come to think of it as typical of the rich and powerful, and we want our revenge. Fast forward to today, and we have Mr. John Thayne, who's running a company which in 12 weeks lost $15 billion. Nonetheless, he gets $4 billion worth of bonuses for his own company, Merrill Lynch, and he also redecorates his office to the tune of $1.2 million, including a $35,000 commode. A commode, ladies and gentlemen, is not a toilet. Be not confused. It is a European cabinetry piece of work. $35,000. Paid for with probably backdoor government taxpayer money. So you're outraged. And that is the mood of the country. And the mood of the country says, we not revenge, we want fairness. We want fairness reintroduced into our system. And we're going to get it. We're going to get it. We're going to change the tax structure. Remember, very recently, President Obama has moved to put a cap on executive salaries for those companies which receive government money. Wildly popular. Wait until it's extended, and it will be. It will be extended to all executives. The government is about to organize the pay structure of America. Be careful. You may get what you want. You may get what you wish for. Trade policy is going to become much more restrictive. Regulatory policy, much more harsh. All in the interests of fairness and a shift in our financial culture. And lastly, we're going to be moving towards a period of thrift. Excessive, overt consumption is now out. It is gone. There is a Tiffany store on Rodeo Drive, California, which now offers people who buy something there, not that distinctive cute little blue bag, no, a plain white bag, because conspicuous consumption is out. There is a shift in our financial culture, and we're right in the middle of it. I want to conclude this section by just going off on a sidebar, a tangent for a second, if you don't mind. This whole story, this whole development, to me, just is extraordinary. And it brings home globalization. Globalization that we barely understand how far down the road we've gone towards globalization. It is astonishing. Iceland goes under, and the ripple effects from that rock chucked into the Atlantic pond ripple within a tenth of a second around the world. And so, to make my point on globalization and how we don't really realize how far we've gone, I'm going to serve up to you a rather old story. I was in Washington. I had to make a presentation on trade. I sat down for dinner, and to make my point that globalization is upon us and part of our everyday mundane lives, I made a list of which countries supplied my dinner. Now, that's a mundane story for you, and here's the list. The main course was salmon, flown in fresh from Norway. Nothing unusual about that. The water for my dinner glass came from Italy. Can you imagine a generation ago importing water from another continent at five times the price of gasoline? Tell me this is not a globalized economy, please. The wine at night was from France. This was when they were feeling good about America and we were feeling good about them. The tablecloth was made in China. The little napkins were hand-stitched in Bangladesh. The flowers were from Colombia in Latin America. The candle holder in the center of the table was made in Taiwan. And to be truly global, the waiter was a Mexican. Now, that's a global economy. But hold on a second, hold on. It's not a one-way street, it's a two-way street. I did exactly the same thing in Hong Kong. Had to go to cover the opening of the Wynn Casino in Macau. Sat down in Hong Kong, ate a meal. Where does the meal come from? Okay, here's the list. I'm an Englishman, originally. Been here 35 years, but I'm still an Englishman. And I like tea. The milk for my tea in Hong Kong that day, came from California. Milk from 6,000 miles away? A perishable product? Fresh in Hong Kong from 6,000 miles away? That's extraordinary. The steak at night was Iowa corn-fed beef. The grapefruit next day came from Florida. The cheese was actually from Wisconsin. And I kid you not, even in Hong Kong, yep, the waiter was a Mexican. It's extraordinary. I mean, it's extraordinary. So now the bit you've all been waiting for, where Stuart Varney, father of six, talks about fertility rates and demographics. And I'm making a joke of it, but this is a very, very serious subject. And believe me, it is upon us now, as I shall demonstrate. It's upon us. This is a demographic problem that is looking at us, staring us in the face down the road, but it's upon us already. Okay, the fertility rate is defined as the number of live births per 1,000 women of childbearing age per year. Okay, that's the fertility rate. You need a 2.1% number to keep your population dead stable. If you've got a fertility rate of 2.1, your population doesn't go up and it doesn't go down. It stays flat. All right? That's the magic number, 2.1. Consider this. In Italy, Greece, and Russia, the fertility rate is 1.2. In Germany, Spain, and Japan, very significant countries, the fertility rate is 1.3. In all of Eastern Europe, the old Iron Curtain countries, okay, 1.3 or less. In all of Scandinavia, it's 1.5 or less. In all of Western Europe, the whole ball of wax, throw it all into one, all of it, 1.9 or less. The highest is France, 1.9. If you strip out Muslim births, it's 1.6. So essentially, nowhere in Europe is there replacement level fertility. In South Korea, it's 1.5. In Taiwan, it is 1.5. In Singapore, it's 1.1. And where do you think is the epicenter of population decline? It is the middle class of Beijing, Shanghai, Guangdong, and all of Hong Kong, where the fertility rate is 0.9, ladies and gentlemen. That's it. What does this mean? It means that throughout the developed world, wherever you have development, and by that I mean a mass middle class, a female education, and the availability of birth control, if you've got those three factors, your fertility rate is below replacement level. Period. That's it. It's down. Which means all kinds of societies are about to experience population decline or have already started. Some have. Germany, in 2007, lost 150,000 people. We don't know what the number is for 2007. Don't have the figures yet, but it's likely to be a quarter of a million. This gains pace. In Finland, there were 10,000 fewer Finns in the year 2007. You didn't know that. No headlines here, but boy, did that raise an earthquake in Finland. Shrinking population up there in the frozen tundra. They had an election about it. They swept away 40 years of socialism and brought in conservatives who evidently thought we could do something about fertility. Anyway, Russia. I've got six kids, okay? Right. Russia. Now, here's a fascinating story. Russia, at the end of communism, 1993, there are 149 million Russians. That's 1993. Today, there are 142 million Russians. They're down 7 million, ladies and gentlemen. 7 million fewer souls. And by the way, Russia is the only predominantly Caucasian society where longevity rates are falling. The life expectancy of a Russian male is 58 years. Lower than Bangladesh, ladies and gentlemen. Such are the ravages of vodka. Well, no, don't get me wrong. Don't get me wrong. I will drink a screwdriver or a Bloody Mary with any of you. I just don't like my vodka by the liter. You know what I mean? Okay. So, right at the time that this is happening, as populations are falling, they're also aging. We're living a lot longer. A lot longer. Life expectancy in Japan for both men and women is now well over 80. In America, it's 79 for women and 77 for men. We are really living a lot longer. But this brings huge demographic strain because, as I said earlier, all these societies, they're having ever fewer children. But essentially, that group of people that is spreading and getting larger in society is that group of people which is retired, living on the health and pension benefits of an ever smaller workforce, which is in turn having ever fewer children. Now, something's got to give, especially where governments or companies give a guarantee of health and pension benefits for all retirees. That's the problem with Detroit. It's not the quality of their cars. It's the lavish promises that they have made to retirees for health and pension benefits. This is an extraordinary cost because of demographics. There's nothing ideological or political about that statement. It is demographics. If you're a bus driver in New York City, you get $60,000 a year. That's your average salary. You can retire at the age of 55 or after 20 years of service on half pay for life and full health payments, free health care for life. Okay? Now, just think about this for a second, ladies and gentlemen. Half pay for life and free medical for life. And you retire at 55, you're going to live for 30 years, for crying out loud. You're going to live 30 years. You're going to be paid and covered for health for 30 years. You only work for 20. There is not enough money on the planet, ladies and gentlemen. It doesn't exist. The crunch is upon us. This latest bailout, the stimulus package, much of the spending is going to states. And the states are going to use that money to pay the health and pension benefits of their retired government workers. There's going to be hell to pay. When you find out that your pensions, if you've got a private 401k or an IRA and you've been decimated, you now find that your tax money is going to be taken off you and directed to California, the left coast, where they have lavish pension and health benefits for thousands, hundreds of thousands of their retirees. Well, you can't cut that. You're devastated. Pay up. You've got to pay them. There's a political problem here, a big one, and it's right upon us, right now. But just let me demonstrate how it's not as bad here as it is there. One last statistic, and I will finish. In Italy, 10.5 years from now, in other words, by the year 2020, in Italy, 55 out of every 100 people will be 65 years old or older. Just let me sink in for a second. Let that sink in. 55 out of every 100 people are 65 or older. That's a mere 10.5 years away. 10 years and 9 months and whatever it is. That's how far it is away. That's that situation there. Can you imagine? That's not a viable economic society. That's not viable. You can't do that. Italy will look like a gigantic Fort Lauderdale. Incredible system. Well, you think I'm making a joke? Have you seen Italy on a map? Looks just like Florida on a map. I mean, vast retirement community. And by the way, in Germany, 49 out of 100 people will be 65 or older. France, 52. Japan, 51. And what do you think it is in America? How many people in 10 years' time will be 65 or older in the US of A? Any guesses? Don't guess, I'll tell you. 29. 29 compared to 55 in Italy, 49 in Germany, 52 in France, 51 in Japan. 29 in the United States of America. Yes, this is a youthful and dynamic society to this day. Why? Because we accept, willingly or otherwise, mass immigration. There's a couple of million eager baby makers in Mexico and Central America eager to come up here and help with our demographic problem, ladies and gentlemen. Okay? Puts a different spin on the concept of immigration, does it not? So in closing, I am going to ask for, I am going to demand a round of applause from you, wait for it, I'll cue it, from you to me. Why? Because it's people like me who come to this country and have six, count them, six children, who will keep you in your old age pension, health, and benefits. I expect a ripple of applause to go through this auditorium. A little tepid on the front row there. I thought, well, ladies and gentlemen, I've got a few minutes left. If anybody has any questions, I'd be delighted to go at it with anybody. I've been contentious. Just raise your hand and I'll shout out your question from the front. Anybody of any kind? Any questions? Go ahead. Hit me. Yeah, so right there. Yes, sir. Yep. The lady asks, the next crisis on her horizon is defaults on credit card debt. And you'd like to ask my opinion on it. Okay, it's already here. It's already here. Credit card debt is bundled, sliced and diced, and sold off as an investment. As the credit card default rate goes up, some of those sliced and diced investment vehicles are worth a whole lot less than what you paid for them. Some have gone into default already, and that accounts for some of the losses which you're now seeing in places like Bank of America and especially Citigroup. It's bled over. It used to be subprime mortgages. Then it bled over into not quite so subprime mortgages, but mortgages nonetheless. Now it's spilled right over into the credit card arena. It's spilled over into car leasing investment, that arena, and also into corporate bankruptcies. Every time you hear of a bankruptcy, any place, a bank has lost money. And there have been innumerable bankruptcies reported recently. And there's a lot more to come. So your question is very well placed, but your timing is slightly off. It's not the big bad thing on the horizon. It's here already. It's here. Yes, Alison. Did you all hear the question? The question is from a former Goldman Sachs worker, I might add, ladies and gentlemen, who asks, look, Goldman Sachs wants to give back some of this rescue money that it got from the government, in part because it doesn't want this salary cap on the very rich guys who run and who used to work for Goldman Sachs. So the question really is, why can't they give it back and why did they take it in the first place? Okay. First of all, not all of these banks wanted this TARP money. It was stuck down some of their throats. Yeah, I mean, it really was. I mean, you think of these greedy bankers just grabbing armloads and bucketfuls of money and just walking away with it and using it. A lot of them did not want it. I had a conversation, as a matter of fact, with a chairman of a bank, not a big bank, a reasonable-sized regional bank. I had a conversation with him. He's very profitable. He never invested in subprime mortgages, never messed around with credit card debt, nothing, period. The guy ran a straightforward business. He gave you a mortgage, he kept the loan. He didn't sell it on and slice and dice and sell it around the world. No, he did old-fashioned banking. He is profitable. He's doing well. The government insists he takes rescue money. His board of directors, he doesn't want to take it. He doesn't want to know about this. He doesn't want it. But his board of directors is saying to him, take it. You must take it, because if the banking system deteriorates in the next year and our stock price goes down, we will be sued. We will be sued because we didn't take government money when it was available. Take it. You got to take it. And he did. So to some degree, there are plenty of banks out there. Jamie Dimon, for example. Chase. What is it again? Morgan Stanley Chase? Morgan? What? J.P. Morgan Chase. You know more about this than I do. J.P. Morgan Chase. They all changed. I can't keep track. Jamie Dimon runs J.P. Morgan Chase. Very successful banker. Emerged from this better than anybody else. He had to take $10 billion. He was in the room when Henry Paulson slid the piece of paper across the table and says, you're going to take it. They had no choice. They took it. They had to. Any other questions? Yes, yes, sir. The financial expert, J.P. Morgan Chase. Yes, sir. Okay. Actually, that's a very good question, and I want to answer it. And not at length, but I'll get right to the point. Okay. First of all, when we're going to pass this stimulus package, it's going to happen. That will push our deficit, that it goes to $2 trillion this financial year. From October of 08 to October of 09, we're going to have a deficit of $2 trillion. We have to borrow that. In the past, we've relied heavily on foreigners, especially China and Japan, to buy our way out of our debt situation. I don't think they're going to be prepared to lend us $2 trillion this year, a couple of trillion the year after, and so on down the line. I don't think they're going to be prepared to do that. And the crunch is going to come at some point. I don't know in what form it'll take. I think interest rates will rise. They've already started to rise. I don't want to get technical, but the yield on the 10-year Treasury has gone from 2.07% to 2.9% in about 4 weeks. That is a big deal. It's a big deal because the market realizes we need to borrow armloads of money from anybody who will lend it to us, and we've got to make it attractive to lend it to us by giving them a good rate of interest. That's what's happening. So that's a real negative. So there's a heavy-duty gamble on this 900, 800, whatever it is, trillion-dollar stimulus package. But if I may, I want to close with something. I want to close with something which you might not realize. I don't mean to have painted a doom and gloom picture this afternoon. And I realize that to some degree by talking about this cascade of events, I have been somewhat negative. I will tell you this, and this is my parting shot. It will be America which comes out of this first. That is a guarantee, because it is only America which can lead everybody else out of this. Why? Because we have a $14 trillion a year economy. We are by far the dominant, biggest, baddest gorilla in the patch. $14 trillion. The next largest economy is Japan. $4 trillion, less than a third of our size. The third largest is China, struggling to make $3 trillion. And the fourth largest is Germany at $2.8 trillion. So we are the only ones who can pull that lot out. They cannot lead us. And there's another reason. America is a gigantic economy. The second largest economy is Japan, which relies entirely upon exports. They can only export to us or the Europeans. They have no domestic demand, very limited, because their population is shrinking. You don't spend money when you're shrinking and aging. They cannot pull us out. Third is China, totally dependent upon exports. They cannot grow unless they can export to us. So we have to lead them out of it. That's why, sir, they will continue to buy our debt. Because it's in their interest for us to grow. Fourth is Germany, which is entirely export-oriented. Second, third, and fourth largest economies in the world are export-oriented. They export to us. They can't grow unless we do. We will be first out of this because we have to be. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Give yourselves a round of applause. You're Americans. Thanks very much, everyone. Thank you very much. Thank you, John.